This is The State of Things. I'm David Crabtree. Perhaps no other public debate is more important than the one about the environment. Environmentalists and some scientists predict a startling erosion of our natural resources over the next several decades. Others claim that man's influence on his surroundings is a necessary byproduct of economic progress, and not as bad as some would say. Even with the differences of opinion, no one wants to see our state lose its natural beauty. Here to help us understand the sometimes complicated environmental issues affecting North Carolina is Jack Betts. He's a writer, associate editor, editorialist, amongst other things, for the Charlotte Observer. He's also the author of a recently published top 10 list of the state's most challenging environmental problems of the past year. Jack, thanks for being with us today.
Good to be here, Dave.
We're also welcome your calls this hour at 1-877-962-9862. Jack, you've been writing and producing this particular list of environmental challenges for the past 8 or 9 years or so. Why is it such an important topic to you, and how did all this come about?
Well, the Charlotte Observer, about 9 years ago, took a look at coverage of the environment in North Carolina and decided that no one was really writing about for the environment. Ed Williams, who's editorial page editor of the Observer, asked me to concentrate coverage of our opinion writing on things environmental, and since then the Observer has put an enormous amount of time and resources into taking stock of where we are each year on the environment. It's admittedly a subjective report, but we review the news, the reports that have been issued, talk to regulators, to scientists, academicians, to environmental groups, and to members of the general public about what they see going on in the environment. And ever since then, we have attempted to tell readers the top 10 things we think they need to know about North Carolina.
You write in this last section, "This assessment is subjective. It's not scientific. Any resident might come up with a different list of concerns and conclusions, and that's just what we intend, to foster debate and focus attention on North Carolina's 10 most critical environmental challenges." So you really want to stir them up.
Yes. We're hoping to get people talking about this and thinking about the things that we do. So much of our environment is affected by the things that you and I do in our daily lives, getting in the car and driving two blocks for a loaf of bread, for example, the fertilizer we put on the lawn. Everything we do has a small impact on the environment, and in a state that's growing so rapidly, it's becoming a faster cumulative impact.
The first thing on this list is climate change. Does that mean it is the greatest concern as far as you're concerned?
I think I tried to make an argument that this is something that we haven't thought about as a people until very recently. We've heard about climate change and global warming for a good long time. I remember two or three decades ago, you probably do as well, that there was some concern that the climate might be cooling because of global cooling. But scientists tell us that there's more concern about global warming, as evidenced by the shrinking of the ice caps. And slight but steady, noticeable rises in sea level that already are having an effect on North Carolina's northeastern estuary and shoreline. East Carolina University coastal geologist Stan Riggs has done research there for 30 years and noticed that it has documented, in fact, the recession of the shoreline for number of factors are at work there. Of course, storms take their toll. Man-made actions have an impact. Mm-hmm. But he has concluded that we're losing hundreds of acres of shoreline each year because of the rise in sea level.
I want to come back to this year's list in just a moment. Do you remember what was the greatest concern 9 years ago when you put this together for the first time?
I think the first year we did it, we took note of the enormous amount of growth around Charlotte and the state's other urban centers, Greensboro, High Point, Winston-Salem, and Raleigh-Durham and Chapel Hill, and also places that we normally didn't think of as growing urban areas, Dare County, New Hanover County near Wilmington, and I believe we ranked growth and sprawl as the number one problem partly because growth and sprawl seem to encompass almost every other environmental challenge that we have, including loss of forest, loss of habitat, air pollution, water pollution, the whole range.
And growth and sprawl are number two on this list.
It's remained on our list pretty near the top ever since.
Yeah, there's a new report out today that North Carolina once again has cracked the top 10 as the fastest growing states in the country. We continue to absorb people by the hundreds here, I presume, on a daily basis. And that balance between how fragile the environment is versus how resilient it is something that it's hard for some people to understand, and that's why there's such division over how much attention we should or should not pay to this.
Yeah. Well, it's a balance that the state officials have pondered for years. North Carolina has been a growth state for the better part of my working life. And that's good. We want growth. We want the economic growth that comes from this. We want the cultural and social growth and the prosperity that has come to North Carolina since the middle part of the 20th century. And along with that growth comes the possibility of environmental degradation. Also, the opportunity to do things right and to develop communities and businesses in a sustainable way, in a way that minimizes adverse impacts on the environment and creates the possibility of continuing to grow the crops that we need and to preserve the open space and create the parks and recreational opportunities that a thriving society is going to want.
Jack, when you write this list or when you write other columns about the environment, do you hear from people who say, okay, Mr. Betts, we're all concerned about our environment. However, cut me some slack. This really does not impact me this directly right now, and quite frankly, I don't think it's going to in the future. What do you say to those folks?
Yep. I don't argue with those folks because I understand what they say, when this most recent environmental package appeared in the Charlotte Observer 2 weeks ago. One caller pointed out to me his belief that global warming had occurred steadily since the last ice age, and that this posed no particular problem to North Carolina's survival. And he's right. We are going to survive for a long time, but climate change is going to affect, if these trends continue, what North Carolina looks like, what crops we grow, what our economic future looks like, the air that we breathe. For example, continued sea level rise will eventually change the shape of the Outer Banks, and it will also change the way our sounds consume the shoreline around the mainland. There are predictions that ultimately Raleigh's current climate will be common in areas around New Haven, Connecticut, whereas Jacksonville, Florida's climate will be more familiar to Raleigh and Durham and Chapel Hill, North Carolina, by the end of the century. We don't know if that will occur or not, but these judgments are made on the most recent rate of change of the ice cap melting, for example, and temperatures rising.
You talk about regulatory impotence. It's tough to get lawmakers, those who make decisions, or is it tough? Let me ask you this way, in your opinion, for them to pay as much attention to these issues as they should when the state is dealing with an $800 million shortfall,
sure,
or we're worried about other issues of losing jobs and how do we keep the economy going. Yes, we will pay attention to this. We will get to it, but just not right now.
This is the baffling conundrum about North Carolina. Our General Assembly pays attention to the environment and over the years has adopted some extremely forward-looking environmental laws. The Coastal Area Management Act was adopted in the early 1970s, during the time when we had our first Republican governor, by the way, and he supported that. And it has kept North Carolina's coastline from looking like what you might see in New Jersey or Florida.
And that coastline is not only along the ocean, but also along the rivers and sounds.
That's right. The Coastal Area Management Act has overall been an excellent policy to guide coastal growth. Now, there are a good many people who tell you it hasn't worked as well as it ought to have, that not enough counties adopt land use plans and or not enough counties adhere to the land use plans. But it's been a good one. Where we fall down is the legislature, in addition to adopting good environmental laws, empowers the Rules Review Commission to review proposed changes in rules by which the state enforces environmental laws, and that's where it gets hard to enforce the law.
This is The State of Things. We're talking today about North Carolina's top environmental challenges. Associate editor of the Charlotte Observer, Jack Betts, is here with us in the studio, and we'd like to hear from you at 1-877-962-9862. Just ahead, we'll get to your calls and talk more about climate change in the state. Support for The State of Things comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners who support WUNC. This is The State of Things. I'm David Crabtree. We're talking today about North Carolina's top environmental concerns of 2004. Jack Betts, associate editor of the Charlotte Observer, is with us in the studio. He began that list 9 years ago. And number one on this year's list of concerns is global warming. Bill Schlesinger is the dean of the Nicholas School of Environment at Duke University, has studied climate change. Thanks for joining us.
Glad to be here.
Okay, assume that I've been living under a rock the past few decades. Can you describe for me in 25 words or less what global warming is and what causes it?
Global warming is caused by rising levels of carbon dioxide and other gases in the atmosphere that essentially trap the heat radiation leaving the Earth's surface that would otherwise escape to outer space. The more of those gases you have in the atmosphere, then the warmer the planet is likely to get. And since we began burning fossil fuels, coal and oil, 150 years ago, we've been adding substantial amounts of carbon dioxide to Earth's atmosphere, and the current rise is what leads to the concern about climate change.
So is the change caused by humankind far more than it is by the natural evolution of the Earth?
The bulk of the scientific community, probably the largest consensus I've seen on any issue recently, believes that the current warming is something outside of what we would expect for natural variability. Climate is one of those things that's hard to study because, of course, every day you wake up, the weather is different. So there's a lot of variability. And it's very important to try to tease out what might be caused by humans above and beyond the underlying background variation.
Why are there so many people who are skeptical about what you're saying?
There's a large urge, because fossil fuels have brought such great bounty to our economic system, to not upset that apple cart, that the continued use of fossil fuels to bring us the products we enjoy, the personal transport that allows great mobility in our society, the warmth and air conditioning that tempers our environment, all kinds of reasons why the use of fossil fuels has made a very high and envious status of living in this country and other countries in the Western world, and therefore a number of lobbies and peoples are certainly working to, as said, not change that source of well-being.
Well, I will ask you this, and Jack Betts as well. If you're trying to convince someone of saying why you should pay attention to this, why this is serious, how do you convince them?
Picking up on something Jack said a minute ago here on the program, the caller that said it's been warming since the last ice age, why should I be concerned? As I was listening to that, it struck me that we are projecting as much warming in the next 100 years as the Earth may have had over the last 10,000 years since the last ice age. That's a little too simple. But it means that we are moving into an era where there would be really unprecedented climate change, unprecedented in the rate of change. Much of our society has been built around anticipating a reasonably stable or a very slowly changing climate. And when you start to project very rapid climate change on it, this will be hugely disruptive to a number of segments of the economic and social system, the agricultural segment, forestry segment, water supply segments, that every citizen should be concerned about.
But it's nothing like Hollywood would have us believe it could be, right?
The day after tomorrow was interesting to talk about, but that was way Hollywoodized.
A fantasy, and even those who enjoyed the special effects don't invest much belief that anything like that will happen with that kind of speed. I think the thing that that may convince people that this is real is when they ponder the economic impact of what this all means and how global warming will alter our ability to grow crops. For example, Dr. Schlesinger not so long ago told the North Carolina Environmental Review Commission that, for example, global warming might mean that hardwood forests would grow better, and that softwood forests, that range might move to the north. That's a long-term implication.
More acorns and pine cones?
in some parts, maybe.
Yeah. Certainly, well, right now, if you look at where trees grow and how well they grow, it's very much correlated with the climate of the region. As the pine trees, coniferous forests in general, have a certain range that is prescribed by climate. And so when we project ahead where the climate regions will be in North America in the future, it may very well be the case that conifers, loblolly and slash pine in particular, that the center of their range isn't here in the southeast. Now, you may say that'll happen slowly and the like, but I challenged every forest products industry executive sitting in their boardrooms thinking, gee, what should I plant on 100,000 acres today, because I'm going to need to be harvesting it in 50 years from now, that they really ought to be concerned about climate change, and the implications of climate change may very well influence their decisions and the economics of those decisions.
We are taking your phone calls at 1-877-962-9862. Jim from Cary is on the line with us. Jim?
Hi. Thanks for the program. We don't hear enough about the environment on the news nowadays, especially in North Carolina. Two questions. Mr. Betts mentioned that someday we could see New Hartford, Connecticut temperatures in Raleigh, and I wonder if he could, without going into great detail, explain how that's going to happen.
Sorry, if I said that, I said it the wrong way. I think Raleigh temperatures may be in New Haven, in the Hartford area.
The other thing was tertiary treatment in North Carolina. Has anybody studied the impact of tertiary treatment, and how many areas in North Carolina utilize that presently?
Well, let's talk about that treatment. Jack, you want to start?
I'm not sure what you're talking about, tertiary treatment. Are you talking
tertiary
about
tertiary treatment of sanitary waste? And
sanitary waste.
So this is taking the nitrate and phosphate out by denitrifying bacteria.
Oh, yeah.
This is Bill Schlesinger. I don't know how many areas are practicing that process in the state of North Carolina. We could probably go around on the web and do a survey and come up with that number. Certainly it's an attractive process because it removes the nitrate that causes so much water pollution problems in our eastern counties and transfers it to the atmosphere as nitrogen gas. That is much less of an environmental problem. I think tertiary treatment has a lot to be said for it.
All right, Jim, we appreciate your call and your questions this afternoon. Speaking of that type of treatment, number 10 on this list from the Charlotte Observer is animal waste. I presume that's been on the list now for quite some time.
It has been there since the mid 90s, obviously because of the impact on eastern North Carolina mm-hmm. and our waterways there ever since the Ocean View Farm incident, where tens of thousands of gallons of wastewater polluted eastern rivers. This is lower than we've placed this in this ranking in years, partly because we're apparently moving closer to an economically effective treatment procedure that the folks at North Carolina State University are developing.
And there's a moratorium.
Yes.
On the building of new lagoons.
Moratorium on the size of hog farms,
right,
and other. Within a few years, they hope to be able to certify some technologies that will allow hog farmers to get away from the open air cesspools containing hog waste, and use that material in a more environmentally sustainable way. There are those who think that this may be a job growth center for North Carolina, which could become a national model for good practices after so many years of being a national model for not good practices.
Now, in the meantime, and hog farmers have taken me to task over this in the past, and it's in no way singling an industry out to make some dire prediction. That's not what I'm doing. But in the meantime, as we're waiting for this new technology, a catastrophe, if we had the perfect storm or the right hurricanes to come through, whatever it may be, eastern North Carolina could be in a serious situation, could
yes.
they not?
In fact, we've seen that once with
right.
Hurricane Floyd.
Right, that's what you're referring to.
Did so much damage in there were so many hog lagoons and hog farms in the floodplain. The state has spent quite a lot of money and effort to move hog operations out of the floodplain, and that's one of the successful things in regards to North Carolina's environment, is the attempt to move those out of the worst or the most dangerous places. There's a lot of work yet to be done there, but we're on the right track.
Let's take another call. This is from Larry in Raleigh. Larry?
Yes. I would like to make a comment about the Rules Review Commission. Can you hear me all right?
Yes, indeed, Larry.
That happens to be one of the most undemocratic bodies that is imaginable, because most of the environmental rules that are proposed have and approved by these great commissions that are with lots of experts and lots of staff. You get these rules up into the legislature, and they've already been given a lot of public hearings. And then the Rules Review Commission, because they're under pressure from some of their special interests, they overturn them.
Jack, is he on to something here?
A perfect example of what Larry is talking about is the requirement that North Carolina develop stormwater management rules to control runoff in many urban areas and in some parts of counties where growth has been strong. The State Environmental Management Commission spent several years holding public hearings and taking testimony and developing rules to manage the control of stormwater runoff. The EMC, as it's called, adopted those rules and sent them along to the North Carolina Rules Review Commission, which has legislative, executive, and judicial kinds of powers. These nine appointed members on that commission reviewed the rules and, in effect, rejected them. That left the legislature, which created the Rules Review Commission, with the problem of what to do. Last legislative session, they adopted what many regard as a fairly weak stormwater management bill that doesn't get at all the kinds of stormwater problems that need to be dealt with. Meanwhile, a couple of lawsuits are challenging the validity of the commission itself.
Bill Schlesinger, when you hear these comments or complaints, criticisms regarding the bureaucracy that has built itself around environmental issues, do you agree with that frustration, or do you think that there's more progress being made there?
I'm somewhere in between. From an environmental scientist point of view, it's always frustrating to see progress being made slowly when the results of science at least point to us very clearly what ought to be done. I find it encouraging that the legislature seems to be more and more willing to be informed by scientists and the scientific process in the last few years, and that's an encouraging trend.
Larry, we thank you for that call. Let's go to Tim in Chapel Hill. Tim?
Yes. Other states in the United States and other countries across the world seem to be recognizing the threat of global warming much more readily than we are. And I'm curious as to, you know, some of the things that you're doing, like putting into place these carbon marketplaces and carbon trading systems where the carbon producers, like the utilities and the transportation industry, actually buy credits from the carbon sequesterers, like the forestry and the agriculture industry. Is there any opportunity, do you all think, in the state to actually create some economic momentum and opportunities when we've got both sides of the trading balance here? Can we, instead of looking at the environmental issues as a problem, can we see them as an opportunity to create some economic momentum in the state?
I think, yeah, go ahead.
There are a number of people who believe that that is going to be a part of our future. The folks at Environmental Defense say that's part of the likely future for dealing with animal waste from hog farms and other animal farms. And so I think we're gonna hear more about that subject in coming years.
Bill Schlesinger?
Oh, definitely. Environmental Defense here in North Carolina is very active in examining the benefits of a carbon trading and carbon sequestration scheme that would couple emitters of carbon dioxide to those that might be able to do processes to take carbon from the atmosphere and store it. I think there's tremendous potential. There's a consortium of New England states that are already on to a trading scheme that they'll get implemented in early next year. I think it'll, if we think about going beyond state boundaries, it'll have an even more potential because we do have a lot of sequestration capability here in North Carolina.
Tim, we appreciate your call.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Jack, looking at your list again, climate change we mentioned right off the top. If you look at number four, it's coastal development. You put those two together, that's weighty.
Yeah. If you've spent any time down at the coast,
none
of us have. But that's the problem. The late Richardson Pryor, the congressman from Greensboro, mm-hmm. who chaired the Year of the Coast Commission in 1994, said, you know, we North Carolinians have are loving our coast to death. The very things that we remember about the coast from our younger days and that we want to enjoy again and again and again, that's all disappearing because we buy up the property down there. We build houses. We don't build cottages anymore. We build mansions that occupy more and more of the surface area, creating more and more kinds of runoff problems instead of being absorbed into the ground or held in natural filters called wetlands. They go right into the waters of the Sound and the tidal areas, and we have more and more acres, seems like every year, of closed shell fishing beds because of human impacts, and the coast that we knew and think so fondly of is disappearing. While we consume more and more of the buildable land.
Bill Schlesinger, when you see what's happening and what's been happening along our coastline the past few decades, do you join forces with those like Orrin Pilkey and say that we should just cease and desist right now?
I may not be quite that extreme, but I think we need to be very judicious about how we develop on the coast and where we develop. When I see predictions, the midline prediction of 18-inch sea level rise during the coming century from global warming, I just see the potential for huge disaster along our coastlines, if not from the sea level being 18 inches higher on the average, but from the enormous potential for a hurricane with those higher sea levels to create catastrophic overwash of developed areas. I don't think that any of the development down there is proceeding in a very thoughtful manner about that.
Bill Schlesinger, thanks for joining us today.
Very glad to be here.
Bill Schlesinger is the Dean of the Nicholas School of Environment at Duke University. We'll continue our discussion of the environmental issues facing North Carolina with Jack Betts of the Charlotte Observer. We'll also look at some successful environmental efforts and take more of your calls at 1-877-962-9862 on the state of things. This is The State of Things. I'm David Crabtree. We're talking this hour about North Carolina's environmental concerns. Jack Betts with the Charlotte Observer is here with me in the studio, and we're taking your calls, and there have been some good ones at 1-877-962-9862. You touched on this briefly earlier, Jack, but talking about crops that could be grown or could be lost, sometimes because of pests and addition of bugs here. We're not looking at a biblical plague, are we?
I don't think anybody has predicted that, but they have predicted that if these trends persist, not only would there be more pests and more bugs, there would be the opportunity for more prevalence of airborne and waterborne disease. Backyard gardeners would have more trouble growing tomatoes, a particular concern of mine. But there would be opportunities as well. We, you know, pretty smart people in this state would probably figure out a way to take advantage of those, to take note of the economic opportunities arising. But the point of this is to boost discussion so that we know what's coming.
Mm-hmm. Are you a pretty good grower of tomatoes?
Not lately. I had a terrible crop this year.
Also, I want to go back to your list. I've got several lists here in front of me. One of the things we haven't talked about are the mountains and the concern for air quality in the North Carolina mountains. And as we get there, as we get near that state line between North Carolina and Tennessee in the past few years, there have been some significant concerns. Those of us who live this far east of the mountains, since we're so far physically removed, we don't pay as much attention to it.
The great photographer Hugh Morton talks about the 20 years ago, the opportunity to take crystal clear pictures was much more an opportunity for him than it is today. The mountain vistas are clouded by haze and smog. On the other hand, we have not had in the last year the problems with air quality that we had in some earlier years of the late 90s and the 2000 and 2001. And Dave Moreau, professor of planning over at UNC Chapel Hill and chairman of the Environmental Management Commission, thinks that air pollution is one of those things that probably is getting better. It's difficult to measure reliably, but he thinks that air pollution has responded to the steps that state and local governments, state and federal governments have taken.
On the list of Jack Betts' environmental successes is a waste reduction effort in western North Carolina. Joe Pryor is president of the lumber company Oaks Unlimited in Waynesville, where he is reusing deck boards from discarded shipping pallets to make hardwood floors. And Joe joins us now. Joe?
Yes, David.
Where did you come up with this idea?
Well, it wasn't really my idea. It was an article that I read in a recycling newsletter. Some folks at NC State and Virginia Tech were trying to come up with the best use for these pallets, these discarded pallets, to keep them out of the landfill.
You know, there have been folks in this part of the state, and I know when I lived in Colorado, there was a major effort there to take those pallets out of the landfills and spend a little money, chop them up, if you would, use them for firewood.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see any of that happening in your part of the, in your section of the state?
No, generally they've been used to either make other pallets or they're being ground up for mulch. Okay. And the idea of using them for flooring is just a higher value so that more of them will be used.
And I would think, I'm thinking of the consistency of the wood in a pallet. It would seem it would make for fairly soft flooring, even if you're combining all those elements together. Tell me about this flooring.
Well, there is a lot of selections being done. We are using only hardwoods, and we bring in the hard hardwoods. We're not using poplar or basswood. And from there, we are removing the nails. We're pressing the nails out. We're kill drying the pieces so that you're at 6 to 8%, which is a stable moisture content for flooring.
It sounds like a lot of work. Can you make any money doing this?
Well, that's yet to be seen. It is a lot of work. It's very labor intensive. We're already running a lumber yard here in Waynesville, so you know I'm running it along with my other operations. But we're going to, we're committed to it. We're going to give it a good 12 months trial and see how we come out.
Joe, tell us about the kinds of flooring that you're getting out of those deck boards from pallets. You're making oak and what, maple flooring and what length?
It is a mixed hardwoods.
Uh-huh.
It's everything from walnut and cherry to red oak and white oak and maple and ash.
But this is solid flooring, not that laminated or the
correct.
Engineered stuff.
Correct. It is a solid hardwood floor. It's 3/8 thick. It is pre-finished, so it's ready to be installed. And it goes down just like regular flooring.
Joe, I understand you're a third generation.
Yes, sir.
Lumberman, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever picture yourself doing anything else?
No, I'm very happy in this industry. It's provided a good life for us, and I enjoy doing it.
What do you hear from folks there in your part of the state when they learn of your innovation, or at least taking this idea that you said you read about,
mm-hmm.
and stepping out there on your own and trying to make a difference?
Well, there's been great feedback. I've gotten emails and phone calls from all over the country. There's a lot of interest in the product, and I just hope that we can put out a product that the quality is right and at a price point that the market will receive.
Well, I mean, here is Joe. As an entrepreneur, there are also some private landowners who are committed to conservation projects. On the line with us now is Guy Troy, a 34-year Army veteran, farmer in Randolph County. He works on his 309 acres that he inherited at birth. And I understand that that property, that 309-acre farm, is not, I would presume I can say, never going to be developed?
Yeah, that is correct.
And you've deeded this, or at least those development rights, to the Piedmont Land Conservancy.
Right. All of the development rights are deeded to them, so the property can never be developed, no matter who owns it.
And, Guy, did you do this to protect the property, to protect yourself, to create a buffer for other folks in the area?
No, just to protect the property. The land's been in the family for 180 years, and I inherited it when I was born, and I did not want it ever to be developed. So I donated the development rights so that it can never be developed and remain in the manner in which I received it.
What prompted you to do that? And when you first thought about this, what were your concerns about proceeding?
Well, I have been a member of the American Farmland Trust for about ever since they started, I guess, which is, 15, 20 years, I forget. So I've been aware of what conservation trusts are. And then, of course, recently we've seen many of the conservation trusts be developed in North Carolina. And so now it's close to home. I looked in a little bit more thoroughly, but I've been thinking about it for a very long time.
Guy, tell me what that farm looks like.
It's mostly in timber. Let's say that. Most of it in timber. About 30 acres of it is cultivated that I grow corn and soybeans, and a couple acres that I've been growing Christmas trees, but I'm not going to do that anymore. We've got a pond on it. There's a couple of power lines that run through it, and a road that run through it. And we have, there's a small house and then the large house that we live in. But mostly it's in timber.
May I ask why no more Christmas trees?
I'm aging out.
Not the trees, but you.
Yeah, that's right. It's pretty labor intensive, and you've got to stay on it. You've got to shear in the summertime and that sort of thing. And we've been doing it for about 20 years. No, I'm just getting too old to do it.
Typically, what does your arrangement let you do in terms of working with the land you have under the program?
Well, how do you mean that? What was the question again?
Well, for example, do you have a management plan? Are you able to do some timbering in that land?
Oh, yeah. We have a forest management plan.
Right.
Which you follow very closely. And I have a consulting forester, Dan Edwards, who lives in Asheboro. And although I'm quite conversant in forestry business, I have found that it really pays to have a professional as my consultant who looks over things, advises me. Anytime, for instance, we had some damage due to the ice storm, so we had to clear cut part of it, and he took care of all that, and then we replanted, and he took care of all that. So, yes, I have a management plan, and I have a consulting forester that looks after it and makes sure that we do everything right.
So you're able to both protect it and keep it productive as well.
Oh, absolutely.
Is the point.
It's got to be productive. And I've done something which I think is a little unique, but I think most interesting, is that I took the land. I formed a subchapter S corporation and put the land in the corporation. And I maintained a controlling interest in the corporation, but I have given my two sons stock in the corporation. So that when I die and my wife dies, they don't inherit the land. They inherit stock in the corporation. Now, that precludes any arguments, like so many farmlands run into now when the owner dies and they've got five or six kids or something, and the kids are arguing about who's going to own what and whatever. This way, they own stock in the corporation. So if we harvest timber, they get a share of the profits that go depending on what their shares are. So I think this is an excellent way to pass on land. If people want to keep it in the family, it's an excellent way to do that. And it also contributes when the kids get a little check in the mail, it kind of gets their attention, you know.
Oh, yeah. Sounds like a process that you would definitely recommend to other landowners around
the
state.
Yeah, I have found it very, very sad because I've seen so many cases where normally, you know, after several years, people have amassed a fair amount of land, perhaps family land, and then they die. And they've got anywhere from 2 to 5 kids or whatever, sometimes more. And then what to do with the land? And then you have to go out and you survey it and you see what the value is and split it up. And you end up splitting up all the land into little parcel products, areas that are not as productive as one whole one might be.
Guy Troy, we thank you for talking with us. And maybe next Christmas, if you don't want to harvest those trees, I might just slip over there and
well,
and find one.
I've got enough for next year, and they're all twos and cuts. So if you want to come in the fall and pick it out, we'll hang a tag on it for you.
Outstanding. Guy Troy is a farmer and landowner in Randolph County. And Joe Pryor, who was with us, is president of the lumber company Oaks Unlimited in Waynesville.
David, you know, people may not know this, but North Carolina really has a remarkably strong conservation and land trust movement, and it is really one of the unsung stories of North Carolina. One reason why our environment is in such good shape, I think, is that there are strong conservation trust movements across the state from the coastal plain up into the mountains, and they do great work.
And the people who are committed to it are passionate about their commitment, and oftentimes it's a very quiet but deep passion that goes with this.
Yep. And you will encounter an amazing diversity of folks who are interested in this. It's not simply the typical, the stereotypical tree hugger, liberal environmentalist. So many people involved with land preservation are very conservative folks who know that conservation and conservative come from the same root and who want to preserve what's good about North Carolina and have done remarkable things.
Are you more encouraged 9 years into this project than you were when you began it?
I have learned, I have been surprised and happy to learn that there are so many good private and cooperative nonprofit ventures making a difference in North Carolina's environment. If we expect government to do it all, we're going to be awfully disappointed because government's not equipped to do all the kinds of environmental protection that needs to be done. But fortunately, there are groups like the Nature Conservancy, Environmental Defense, the Sierra Club, and others who that cooperatively work with businesses. Many of them have a strong environmental ethic, and I think it's getting stronger as businesses have learned that good environmental stewardship affects the bottom line. You can make money off this.
Jack, I know you don't have a crystal ball, but if you're looking into the future and thinking about your children or grandchildren, will they, in their lifetimes, talk about sprawl as a thing of the past?
I don't think so. I don't think sprawl is easily solvable. But I think we will see more and more developers building more wisely. There was a short-circuited movement a few years back to go in for smart growth. The effort seemed not to go anywhere, but you'll notice that the state's more effective developers are making wise choices about the use of land and how they develop, and we're getting, I think, in pockets, much better growth than we ever have.
Let's try to get one more caller. Jenny?
Hi.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. My question is related to tax benefits that a landowner might receive by entering into a land conservancy situation by deeding his or her property.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any way to help a landowner from a tax perspective?
I'm not an expert at all on this, so I could not speak in detail, but there are some excellent opportunities, I understand, and a good many landowners in North Carolina have taken advantage of the opportunity to set aside open space and lands, and they were able to do so because of a pretty nice cooperative arrangement that had some tax advantages.
It's definitely worth checking out. Jenny, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Jack Betts, good to have you here with us.
Enjoyed it, David. Thanks.
Always always enjoying talking with you, either about politics or this subject or any other. So good to have you here.
Good to be here.
Jack Betts is associate editor, amongst other things, at the Charlotte Observer. That's the state of things for today. Our show is being produced this week by Alan Meredith, Stephanie Hirsch, David Gura, Dave DeWitt, Keith Weston, and Robin Copley. Fred Wasser is the executive producer. Thanks for listening, and if you have a comment about this program, drop us an email here at sot@wunc.org. Support for the state of things comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. I'm David Crabtree.